Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And what do you make of the rapprochement between Turkey and Israel that was brokered by President Obama? Is that a harbinger of Israel and Turkey working together to do something in Syria, which is pretty much what Prime Minister Netanyahu said? It's all about Syria.
Well, I think there are two things that are important about this. First of all, I don't think we can take Netanyahu at his word. He's a very good politician, which means that after months and months of blaming Turkey for the incident that caused the severing of relations, that all of a sudden now he turns around and says, look, it's Israel's problem. So I'm not sure exactly why he was saying what he was saying, did what he did. The other thing, though, is that, again, I'm not sure that this is a precursor to any action that's going to be taken by Israel or by Turkey. I would look at it more as a preventive measure that they're taking in order to shore up the two boundary borders of Syria, which have been hemorrhaging over the last couple of weeks or so. There are refugees in Turkey, for example, and just the other day there was an exchange of gunfire over the border of the Golan Heights. So I think that both Turkey and Israel are looking at an imploding neighbor and thinking to themselves, what we have to do is to ensure some sort of coordinated measures in the future if necessary.
Well, it seems in terms of affecting the neighborhood, that already it's affecting Lebanon, right, with the resignation of the prime minister?
Oh, absolutely. There is all sorts of difficulties that are taking place in Lebanon at the present time at the Syrian border. Hezbollah, for example, is a strong supporter of the Assads and the regime, and has been in conflict with, for example, opposition military that's crossed over the border seeking sanctuary or to perform raids into Syria. At the same time, Lebanese Sunnis have been working with the opposition in Syria as well, creating friction with Hezbollah in Lebanon. So there's a danger here that the Syrian situation is going to not only expand into, for example, Lebanon, but, for example, Iraq as well. A raid took place, for example, several weeks ago, in which Syrian opposition forces killed Syrian soldiers who had sought sanctuary in Iraq.
They killed a whole busload of them, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Right. So there's a few things going on there. You had the shootout with the Israelis and the al-Nusra people on the buffer zone on the Jordanian Golan Heights border. You've got Secretary of State Kerry went to Iraq to try and get Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to stop allowing Iranian overflights, where the Iranians are more than doubling down supplying military equipment to the Assads. And they seem to be, compared to the West, at least Iran has a kind of a pretty clear policy. Is this doubling down that the Iranians are doing, is it going to be enough to save Assad?
I think there are two things overall that are going on. On the one hand, you have an accelerated implosion taking place within Syria itself. Several weeks ago, for example, the opposition were able to not only take but hold on to a provincial capital, which is the first time they were able to do that. And that's a significant thing. They were notorious for not being able to hold on to territory before. So Syria is accelerating in its decay. At the same time, the United States is flailing about attempting to find some sort of policy that is going to be short of military intervention that will enable the United States to somehow put more moderate elements on top within the opposition itself in Syria. And it's not having much of an effect in Syria. We see this, for example, with the establishment of a transitional government, for example, and the resignation of the head of the coalition at the same time. It's an extraordinarily fractious opposition that we have, and the United States has not been able to somehow mold that into a coherent unit that would be pro-American, pro-West.
Now, the opposition leader you're talking about with the Syrian National Coalition, Ahmed Moaz al-Hatib, he resigned in frustration with the West because he said they were more obsessed about the length of the Syrian fighters' beards than they were about supplying them, where they're so overmatched by Assad's military and particularly the Air Force. But he offered talks with the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, on a condition that 160,000 prisoners are freed. He had his own problems within his own opposition. And so what do you make of the new lead of the opposition, that the American educated leader? Do the fighters in the field in any way report to him?
The short answer to that is no. The problem that the politicals, particularly the exiles, have had in terms of the Syrian opposition has been that there's a disconnect between the political apparatus and the military apparatuses. And I say apparatuses simply because the military still is not a coherent grouping. There are all sorts of factions that are disconnected from each other. So there's no real chain of command within the military. So the transitional government itself has very little power. The very fact that they chose somebody who had been living for decades in the United States, I think, demonstrates the fact that this is not a serious attempt to form a government.
So, again, I'm speaking with James Galvin, who is a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. So, is this Salafist element that we seem to be concerned about with the al-Nusra Front, is it really as big a phenomenon as it's being reported? I mean, is that the reason why the U.S. seems to be kind of unsure about what to do? They seem to always know what they don't want, but they've never been able to express what they do want. Although my understanding is that the CIA have some people in there in Syria that are training and I presume arming certain rebel factions. So what is this mosaic of the Syrian opposition, the rebellion? Do you have a kind of clear picture of it?
There is no clear picture of it. That's the problem. We don't know, for example, the strength of various elements within Syria. That changes from day to day. We also don't know whether or not, for example, any of the pro-Western groups is actually going to gain, let's say, momentum, which seems now to be in Nusra's hands. The thing about, to answer your question, your previous question about the size of the jihadis within Syria, the number of jihadis within Syria, it doesn't really matter. These people have an incredible ability to cause trouble. I mean, for example, when a ceasefire was brokered over an Islamic holiday, the idea being that both sides, the government and the opposition, were going to lay down their weapons for the term of the holiday, Jabhat al-Nusra refused to abide by it, and immediately the ceasefire broke off. So the numbers don't matter. Remember, it took only 19 people to wreak such havoc in the United States. So that's sort of the equivalent of what we're seeing now in Syria.
So what's your day after scenario then, James Galvin? I mean, based on the assumption that the Assads are going to fall eventually, and of course Hillary Clinton and others have said some time ago they were going to fall, and they're certainly taking their time about it.
Well, that's the thing. They're certainly taking their time about it. So one thing that we've learned throughout the Arab uprisings has been that we shouldn't make predictions on these things. There are all sorts of extraneous things that we are not even thinking of at this point, which might come into play, foreign intervention, et cetera, et cetera. But I would leave it with three possible scenarios for Syria. It's going to be the regime is going to crush the opposition, which seems unlikely at the present time. The opposition is going to crush the regime, which is possible. Or there's going to be a protracted stalemate, which we're seeing right now, actually. Now, this sounds rather banal, but think about the way in which, for example, the Egyptian and Tunisian uprisings ended. They ended with military intervention, one part of the regime turning on another part. That will not take place in Syria. Or Libya and Yemen, with the regime just simply falling apart. That also will not take place in Syria. This regime is going to stick together to the bitter end, that bitter end will either mean a victory for the regime, a victory for the opposition, or it'll continue as it's continuing now with this continued decay in Syria.
Well, but isn't it possible, and in fact likely, that the Alawites will retreat to their ancestral homeland on the northern coastal mountain area?
Well, that's been mooted, but I would draw people's attention to a number of factors. First of all, the so-called ancestral homeland, for example, the city of Latakia is majority Sunni, not Alawite, although the rural area is majority Alawite. It's a very mixed area, so there really is no homogeneous Alawite homeland. The other thing is that if, for example, the situation got so bad that the regime decided to retreat to a Alawite homeland, what would prevent the opposition, which would then obviously have the upper hand, from continuing the fight and preventing the regime from becoming ensconced there as well? One thing about the Middle East state system is that as fragile as it appears from the outside, as artificial as it appears from the outside, it's held up remarkably well. And one of the reasons for that is because nobody from the outside wants to see that state system to be remixed again. Nobody would be able to agree on borders, et cetera, et cetera. So there is going to be a single Syria coming out of this. But the question is whether or not it's going to be a real state or whether it's going to be a state like Somalia.
Well, James Galvin, we started out talking about the rapprochement between Turkey and Israel brokered by President Obama and what that means, particularly in terms of Syria. What about the scenario that has often been suggested, that the red line for the Israelis are the chemical weapons being Assad's arsenal being transferred to Hezbollah? And there's already been an Israeli strike against what was seen as a convoy carrying surface-to-air missiles from Assad's apparently fairly substantial inventory into Lebanon. So that seems to be an active possibility. How much is that going to throw a monkey in the wrench?
Well, that is very much of a possibility. Obviously, there have already been cases in which the Israelis have intervened with airstrikes, for example, and back-and-forth artillery duels which have taken place. But I think what we have to do is step back a little bit and understand that every time this occurs, it's a propaganda boon for the Assad government, and the Israelis understand that. The Israelis understand that Assad has been saying from the very beginning that this whole uprising is nothing more than a foreign conspiracy, and it's a conspiracy of jihadis, of al-Qaeda, of Saudi Arabia, of the United States, of Israel, you know, the list goes on and on, Lebanon, et cetera, et cetera. This would only put some evidence, some more evidence, give more evidence to the Assad propaganda. So I think the Israelis have been as much as they can possibly been. They've held back and have only intervened in situations in which they have felt that there was something that immediate action was required.
Well, but doesn't that lead to the conclusion that a desperate Assad will play the Israeli card? He will try to transfer the chemical weapons to Hezbollah or the surface-to-air missiles, inviting the Israelis in. That may be his last card to play.
Well, that might be his last card to play. I mean, there's been all sorts of speculation about Assad using those chemical weapons himself, not transferring them in to anybody, but actually using them against the opposition. There is still a potential for the intervention from the outside against Assad that would be strike quite a blow against the regime if chemical weapons were used. The ability to degrade the army further, the ability to prevent the Air Force from actually using the flight over Syria, et cetera, there is a capacity to do that without putting boots on the ground. So I think that the Assad family and the wider regime is actually holding out, reluctant to use chemical weapons for that very reason, that would be the final blow that the military of the regime would suffer from.
Well, just in closing, James Galvin, what's your sense of whether or not this will end up being a reversal for Iran and for Hezbollah, which seems to be the conventional wisdom? And it also, the suggestion is that the fall of the Assads could create a kind of domino effect in Iraq, where the Sunni are very, very restive, and so are the Kurds. So will this really be a big blow? Because my understanding is that within Iran itself, a lot of the Iranian people are fed up with the enormous amounts of money that have been spent on Hezbollah and bailing out the Assads.
Right, particularly with the sanctions on Iran, the Iranian economy is not doing particularly well. But I think before we begin to gloat and look at, for example, this is a bloody nose for Iran and that whole alliance between Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, and formerly Hamas, which has now defected from the alliance, and Russia as well. I think we should take a step back and see exactly what we're getting ourselves into at the present time, which is the possibility of no government control over large swaths of Syria, which means the possibility for jihadi emirates to establish themselves there, the possibility for a long simmering conflict taking place among rival sects within Syria, the possibility of a protracted civil war that would create even worse of a humanitarian crisis that we have going on right now. It's about 25% of the Syrian population are either internally or externally refugees, have been killed, or have been imprisoned. So what we're talking about is a population that has been extraordinarily brutalized and at the same time a country that appears at the present time to be going the way of Somalia.
Well, James Galvin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he is the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Bye for now. Love.
disappeared by having